This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 67th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me today Bill Pugh. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Gary.
Bill Pugh is a professor at University of Maryland College Park. Bill's a well-known alpha geek who keeps his fingers exceptionally dirty. He has created and run Findbugs, a static analysis tool for Java, invented skip lists, become a Packard Fellow, consulted for Google, debugged Java, and many other related endeavors. His research interests include incremental computation, functional and object-oriented languages, thread safety, and software security. Bill has a BS in computer science from Syracuse and a PhD from Cornell, where he also minored in acting. Bill lives in Maryland with his family and has been known to ignite large bonfires through fire-eating rituals. So thanks for joining us, Bill.
Thank you.
I guess we'll talk about the fire-eating at the very end.
Okay, sounds good.
You've been teaching computer science for many years, mm-hmm. but most likely coding for way longer than that. So a real simple question, how in the heck do you teach kids to code?
So that's tricky. And to some extent, by the time I typically teach the second programming course, mm-hmm. Among my roster of courses I teach. And by that time, they've already gotten sort of a little bit of the idea of algorithmic thinking. Mm-hmm. Right. I remember way back in high school days, I trying to teach some of the other kids to program. And for some of them, just the whole concept of writing things down was very hard. I don't have a lot of experience with how to teach people those initial steps. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of a lot of the stuff that I wind up working with students on is, by the time I get to them, they've sort of already, okay, they know how to write a for loop and to do simple things. Mm-hmm. A lot of what I worry about more is, how do you learn about these new tools, new libraries, new frameworks you're given? And actually, one of the things I've been finding myself spending more time on recently is getting students to write clean, elegant code.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I recently started doing some things where we started doing a lot of code reviews of student code and looking at much more student code than I'd seen before, and it was a little bit scary.
Yeah. Well, we wonder where they learn all these bad habits, and it's probably in school.
Well, I think a lot of it is simply that many students don't actually get that kind of feedback
right.
on their code.
Right.
I mean, where are they going to learn it? And actually, one of the things actually that we don't do a lot with students is we don't spend a lot of time teaching them how to read code.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right. You go to a writing class, you go to English composition, you read stories written by master craftsmen. You talk about how is this structured, what's good about that. We don't do enough of that probably in software classes.
Yeah, and some engineering disciplines may do more of that too, like mechanical engineering, for example. Mm-hmm. So I guess I was wondering whether you might go down this angle, which is the ability to program innate, or can you teach somebody to do it? And you have an opinion on that one? I mean, I ask because right. I started coding at 16 just because I was following my nose. And people that I know that really code, they sort of followed their nose as well into this whole thing. But maybe that was a reflection of the generation that I was in or the discipline or whatever.
I don't think it's so much a matter of some people are just innately better at coding. I think it has to do a lot more with some people find it fun and get excited about it.
Right, okay.
And when they find it fun and they get excited about it, they're going to invest the time into it to do stuff. And actually, most of the people who are good coders have spent more time than just what's required for classwork or whatever they've done. Right. They do other things. And
because they were excited about it.
Yeah. Yeah, and we can try to do things. How do we get more people excited about it?
There you go. I wanted to ask you about Marmoset. I know you've been working on a project
right.
for, you know, thinking about at least languages for making this easier. Can you tell us about that project a little?
Sure. So the Marmoset project, which was the name that the grad student who did it initially named it, it's also more known as the Submit server. It's something that we use for managing student programming projects at the University of Maryland. So let me sort of back up and explain the way that it traditionally student projects were done at Maryland before this came along, the way I think they're done at most universities. Say, here's a programming project, here's some sample input data and the expected output, and tell the students, go to it. Mm-hmm. And they go to work on their project, and somehow they submit their project, at which point it goes into an electronic Dropbox where nobody looks at it till after the project deadline. And after the project deadline, they take the student submissions and run them both against the test data you gave them and against some additional secret test data, which sometimes isn't made up till after the project deadline.
Right.
And maybe a week after the project was due, if you're lucky, the TA gives the grades back to the students. Mm-hmm. So you can sort of see this isn't great. Students don't get a lot of feedback. So what we've got a web-based system so students can submit their projects, sort of similar to other frameworks. And you can also do it through Eclipse and so forth. But as soon as students submit their code, they can go to a web browser where they can see the result of submitting their code. And we show them, here are the results of running it against all the test cases we provided plus the test cases students wrote. We can also give them feedback from static analysis tools, from code coverage tools, and so forth. And we can do that all on the server side so the students don't have to worry about how do I set up code coverage on my workstation.
Cool. That's cool.
And then if students have passed all of the tests that they were given on the instructor's test cases, then they get this little option. Would you like to perform a release test of your code? And the student says, yes, I'm ready to do a release test. And we'll say, okay, maybe this is the poker game project. And we'll say, well, there were 12 release tests. Your code passed 7, but failed 5. The names of the first two tests you failed are test full house and test 4 of a kind.
Right.
And 3 more tests that we're not even going to tell you the names of. And this is all designed because I think everybody sort of believes if you just give the students too much access to the test data, it's not sort of real world. They just wind up
coding to the test.
Coding to the test. Brownian motion until they pass all the test cases.
Right.
Which isn't what you want to do. So students can think, oh, full house, 4 of a kind, I think I know what I did wrong. Go back, change the code, resubmit. Well, they can resubmit as often as they like.
Until the deadline. Yep.
But performing a release test requires a release token. And students are given typically 2 or 3 tokens, and they regenerate 24 hours after being used.
Hmm.
So this has all sorts of interesting effects. It encourages students to start early, because the earlier they get started, the more opportunities they have to do a release test.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of puts them in the framework of a real software developer when you have to think, okay, have I done everything I can do to assure the quality of my code before I commit my code or ship to customers or do a demo or whatever you do in terms of taking software to make it more publicly available.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing which is nice is if students make an incorrect assumption and they do something which is going to fail a bunch of the instructor test cases, well, they find out right then, and they can go into office hours and say, hey, I'm failing all the release tests. I have no idea why.
Right, and get some help.
And get some help, as opposed to not finding out until a week after the project deadline that you messed up. And, of course, we run all the tests as soon as the code is submitted, so the instructors can see this, and they can see which test cases are giving students particular problems. Sometimes students will identify either directly or indirectly a test case that a lot of them are having problems on, and they think their code's perfectly okay, and it turns out that, you know, well, the spec was ambiguous, or your test case was faulty, and there was another way to implement it.
And so I assume the idea is that not only is this more like the real world, but it ends up producing people who can program better?
Right. So, and we have a lot of emphasis on telling students to write their own tests. You know, we tell them, if you find out that you're failing a test full house and 4 of a kind, don't go fix your code. Write a test case, right? Try to duplicate that error, right? If you can duplicate that error, then when you change your code and you fix the test you just wrote, then you have some confidence that when you use your next release token, you'll actually pass the test on the server. And as you make further changes to your code, you won't wind up accidentally breaking that functionality. So yeah, a lot of it's designed to make both more of a real world flavor. And also, I think a lot of it is just trying to make students better coders.
Mm-hmm.
And then the new thing that we've just been adding, I mean, we've had this framework in place for years, for about 5 or so years, various things. And it works for multiple programming languages, and it's used for most all of the programming courses at Maryland. The new thing that we're adding is code review. So we're doing web-based code review, similar to many of the systems that you'll find online, except we're not reviewing code diffs,
right,
which is how it's typically done. Rather, we're just reviewing one version of the code.
Yeah.
And this can be either instructors reviewing the student's code or peer code reviews, where we tell each student gets assigned 2 or 3 other students' projects that they have to review.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can also do things like, okay, here is a standard code that either the instructor's code or a standard library, and all the students have to go through it and review it, and we can give them particular things that they have to identify in it or just write general comments about it. So this gets back to the idea of having students actually read code and comment on it.
Yeah, read it critically too.
Right.
So what are your thoughts about automated code review? And we'll talk about find bugs in a minute, but that versus manual code review.
I think that, so as I look through student code manually, right, I find certain things that I hadn't really been thinking about coming up with an automated tool for this, but now that I see the same problem occurring over and over again,
mm-hmm,
right, maybe we could do something automated for that that would scale better.
Right.
But on the other hand, there's sort of a long tail of bad style and coding mistakes that you can't automate.
Mm-hmm.
And so for that reason, doing the human review is good. I mean, anything that could easily be automated and occurs frequently enough that it's worthwhile automating should be automated. But you shouldn't think that that is, there are some things that doesn't occur enough and it really needs a human eye, and maybe you shouldn't automate that. The other thing is particularly for the students doing the peer code review, I think they get a lot out of looking at
exactly
other students' code and being asked to think critically about other students' code. We just did a project in my class. Students were writing concurrent code, and I told them to try to find bugs in the code of the other students. And I sort of said, if you find a bug, you get a point. The other student doesn't lose anything. And then the student whose code you reviewed, if they find an error in your analysis and their code is actually correct, then you lose a point and they get a point. So it's really, looking at this concurrent code and what are all the possible things that could go wrong. And you don't want people, as a little worried about students just, if I get points for mistakes, I'll claim to find a mistake everywhere.
All out warfare or whatever, yeah.
Right. But it basically set it up so that if they give incorrect reports of errors, they could wind up losing points.
You know the Dilbert that had Wally coding up a minivan. You remember that one?
No, I don't.
They were rewarding programmers in Dilbert Land for fixing their own mistakes.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So, of course, Wally was seeding mistakes first so he could fix them later and reap the reward in the form of a minivan.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about your work that's focused on finding and killing bugs.
Right.
So you've even helped move languages along in the right direction in some cases. So do you think that modern programming languages are moving forward from a security, reliability, and robustness perspective?
Yes. One of the things that a lot of languages have done is that they've managed to take certain categories of errors and just take them off the board, many programming languages say that, memory corruption because you wrote into a random integer, that's just not on the table in a programming language like Java,
mm-hmm,
whereas it is in C. So that's a big win.
Mm-hmm. Type
safety. There are still some things in Java, you can do prepared statements, which avoid a lot of the problems with SQL injection. But you can also still build SQL statements with string concatenation,
mm-hmm,
so you can get bit. And there are a couple of times when you actually want to write a query which actually involves column names being pulled from some data source, in which case you really find yourself doing string concatenation and you feel bad about it. But, that's what you wind up doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the languages are getting better, particularly to the extent that they can take a certain type of problem and just take it off the table. But there's also the problem that we always sort of code to the bleeding edge of our ability to get software stood up.
And slightly past it.
Right. Well, it's the bleeding edge, right? And so anything you do to make software, building software easier, it often doesn't actually make software more reliable. Because what happens is, oh, now I can try to do something more complicated or to do something in a faster development style. And I won't have to do as much testing or whatever I would have to do because I've got this more productive and more reliable programming language.
Interesting. So you built this thing called FindBugs.
Right.
Why?
Oh, so... So the interesting story about FindBugs. So FindBugs is a static analysis tool for Java that finds various kinds of coding mistakes. And so the origin of FindBugs was that I'd previously done work on compressing Java class files for transmission over the network, how to take a collection of class files and compress them very tightly. And as a result of that, I had a whole bunch of tools for picking apart Java class files and understanding them. And I'm good friends with Joshua Block, who's he's currently chief Java architect at Google, was involved at Sun, writing a lot of the Java libraries. He's written books on effective Java. He's written a lot of stuff about how to write good Java code. And I was just talking to him, and he says, yeah, there's this mistake, and people make it pretty often. I said, well, really? You know, I've got a tool that could figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Josh would describe a possible bug pattern, and I could write something, and I could find out how many times it occurred, right? And it initially was a very simple tool. It was a plaything. It was something I could run against a jar file, and it would give you a list to the, you know, standard output, one line per error of the things it found. I think one of the really interesting point. And it sort of moved along, and I had grad student Dave Hoovermeyer, who you know, who worked on this, made the analysis much more sophisticated, did a lot of the more interesting things with the workflow. One of the things that was really interesting, actually had a problem where some students were having a problem with various mistakes. So we were actually using FindBugs in Marmoset. And so students were getting error reports. And students were getting this error, a Stack Overflow exception, which I had not mentioned in class. This was in the freshman course.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at their code, and it turned out that in the constructor for their class, they were constructing new instances of the class. So they got infinite recursive loop. Right. So I actually wrote something to look for that, thinking, well, this would help the students who got confused by that. And then I ran it against Sun's JDK implementation. And I found five of them in Sun's. And it wasn't just in constructors. It was any method that always recursively called itself until the stack was exhausted.
Right.
And one of them was written by Joshua Block.
Did you talk to Joshua about that?
Oh, yeah. I talked to him about it. He got a good laugh. I've made up a series of FindBugs shirts over the times, and one of them has Josh's code on the back.
I remember
Josh's
that
name.
One, actually.
And I've got that shirt, and Josh has that shirt, and he wore it at Sun and at Google and so forth. And part of it is, you know, everybody makes stupid mistakes. And I guess that was one of the things that was sort of evident from the work, is that lots of people make stupid mistakes all the time. Right? And you, in one way or the other, you generally fix them. And the good people make fewer stupid mistakes, and they make them for different reasons.
But not none. Yeah. But there are also subtle mistakes. So in particular, I'm thinking about when you're working in concurrent systems and you have a multi-threaded situation. I happen to believe that time and state errors are the error of the future, so to speak. Do you believe that?
Oh, I mean, there are so many different kinds of errors, and, certainly there are a lot of them. There are so many different mistakes. I'm not sure it makes a whole lot of sense to talk about one or the other. One of the interesting things that I keep on bumping into is this question of, okay, there are all sorts of different kinds of mistakes. And one of the interesting questions is, well, how do these mistakes manifest themselves? Are they obvious if they're manifesting themselves what are the other techniques for finding them?
Mm-hmm. So an observability tweak.
Right. So, for example, a mistake, a method that invokes itself recursively until you run out of stack, that's sort of pretty obvious when it happens,
mm-hmm.
right? You get a nice trace, you know, stack trace when it happens. There are other coding mistakes which silently result in the wrong thing being computed. Some of these result in the wrong thing being computed every time. Some of them result in the wrong thing being computed one time out of 4 billion.
Right. Try finding those.
Right. Yeah. And so, I mean, so a lot of time in space ones, they can, some of them can be tricky, particularly because they're the ones that are not obvious.
Right, yeah. And like you said, they happen one time in 4 billion sometimes. And it's,
well, some of them do. Some of them happen a lot more frequently. I mean, it depends. I mean, concurrency errors. I mean, one of the things which is interesting about concurrency errors is a couple years ago when we, you know, we sort of saw multi-core processors are coming. We sort of knew how poorly a lot of people understood how to write correct concurrent programs.
Yep.
And a lot of people I was talking to 5 or 6 years ago were thinking that by 2011, software was going to be falling down left and right due to concurrency errors.
Uh-huh.
And it's not.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think part of that is because in the overall scheme of software, a mistake that only manifests itself one time out of a billion actually isn't that bad. You know, I mean, of course, it depends on context, right?
Or we're just not leveraging concurrency to do what we could do.
Well,
we're,
you know,
just treating
the other
it like
question
a couple
is,
of chips that happen to be there.
Right. The question is, you know, it's one thing we have 2 cores, 4 cores. When you start going up to 30 cores, this happens more. No, Cliff Click, one of the people that's done a lot of work in Java concurrency, works at Azul Systems. They've got a box where they would have, like, you know, hundreds of concurrent Java cores. And he would say routinely that when the big financial firms would come to them and say, let's see how our software works on your machine, they'd boot it up and it would instantly fall over.
Mm-hmm.
And their reaction would be, oh, your software's crap. And Cliff would say, wait a minute, let me turn on the knob that detects concurrency errors in your code. Okay. And he turned it on. Okay, here you got a data race. Oh, here's another data race. And once they went through and fixed the data races,
got a
the
lot
code
better.
Would be fine.
Yeah.
Because they were running with 700 cores, the concurrency mistakes that were never a big problem with 4 cores became much more severe.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I think it might be good to have a very small aside on the error that you found in the basic Java object a million years ago when it came to concurrency and data race stuff.
So you're talking about the Java memory model?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure so much if it was a mistake. Well, it was. All right, so I'll explain. So Java was one of the first programming languages to actually try to spell out what happened when you have multiple threads interacting through shared memory. You could write multi-threaded programs in C, but it wasn't the compiler's business. The compiler didn't tell you what could happen.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried to spell it out. Unfortunately, the spec wasn't really, it wasn't the spec that, it wasn't what was actually implemented, and it wasn't what people wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that the spec both prohibited a lot of standard compiler optimizations that all of the compilers were doing, and it also forbid some of the optimizations that people wanted to actually do in terms of being able to, for example, remove synchronization from thread local objects. And then there were a few other things that initially volatile was, they just sort of said, oh, volatile, that must have something to do with concurrency, but they hadn't actually figured out how would you actually use volatile in concurrent software.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked with a bunch of people to try to figure out what the semantics should be. And it was amazingly hard. It gets into all sorts of interesting arguments with causality, and you know, we sort of felt we were like, you know, doing time machine
becoming
stuff.
Becoming philosophers.
Yeah. So it, you know, and a lot, there was the spec part that was actually really, really hard. And it turned out that even the thing we came up with had some glitches. But actually the most useful things was we sort of said, okay, here are some behaviors that you can expect, some behaviors that we can guarantee won't happen. And this all fed into, you know, how things work. And partially the other thing that happened in Java is we have, okay, this is what a data race free program is. Mm-hmm. And actually the semantics of data race free programs is reasonably clear, straightforward, exactly what you want. Defining the semantics of programs with data races is hard because of causality issues.
So you do it the other way around.
I don't get that.
Well, what you just said, you know, a data race free thing we can define.
Right. Well, we encourage people to do that, but because Java gives safety properties, one of the things that was actually a challenge is we needed to make sure that even if somebody was deliberately writing data races in order to violate the safety properties of objects, you couldn't get around certain safety properties.
Right, right.
That was the challenge. We had to be protective even in the case of malicious code deliberately using data races.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Like in C, they've now added some thread specification to the C programming language, but the spec basically says that if your program has a single data race, your program has no semantics whatsoever. And of course, we all know that programs never have any data races.
No, never. Can't even. I don't even know what you're talking about. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigital.com/GEM, or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. So let's talk about one language versus the other. What's your favorite language for coding yourself?
Well, I, you know, certainly over the past 10, 15 years, most of what I've done is Java. And, you know, I've started doing a little bit of Python. It's most of what I've spent my time with. You know, I did a bunch of C and C++ back in the days, and I'm glad not to
have to do that anymore. You've been released.
Yeah.
So how about teaching?
Well, mostly I teach Java in the courses I teach. So I teach basically two courses, undergraduate courses. One is the sort of freshman, it's the second freshman programming course. There we get, you know, into all sorts of things, a lot about data abstractions, things like that. And then I teach the deliberately ambiguous course, which is programming language technologies and paradigms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so in that course, we did web applications, web security.
Is that the one I gave a talk for?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was an interesting class.
Right. So for that, you know, for web applications, we actually had the student write a reasonably simple application that they deployed to Google App Engine, where they actually had to write something with forms and a database behind it and worry about things like cross-site scripting and cross-site request forgery.
Mm-hmm. So you sort of touched on this a little bit in previous remarks with regard to somebody intentionally misusing data races to tweak the system. What's the difference between a security bug and not a security bug? Or is that just a meaningless question?
No. There are – I mean, it's not a simple question, not a simple answer. Okay, well, one aspect of a security bug – is it's a bug that would typically only manifest itself when somebody is deliberately misusing the software.
Mm-hmm.
Another characteristic of a security bug is that when it manifests itself and you find out, you think, oh, shit, who do I wind up calling? The, you know, chief technology officer, the police? this is big trouble.
Right.
Right. Uh-huh. So
it all has to do somewhat with intention.
I think and impact, mm-hmm. right? I mean, like, okay, somebody can deliberately misuse your software. I mean, there are all sorts of games that have glitches that allow you to, like, walk through walls, right, and stuff like that. And there's somebody deliberately misusing the software in a way that the developer didn't intend. But, like, okay, so you can walk through a wall. Like, maybe if it's, you know, World of Warcraft and you can walk into the gold vault that, you know, some guild has, maybe that's a problem. But if it's, like, Toontown or something like that, yeah, who cares? And actually, you know, a lot of players in some of these games, they, you know, they're, the glitches are like Easter eggs.
Absolutely.
If you took them away, they would get really upset.
Yep.
So yeah, it's both intention and impact.
One last topic real quick. Sure. So what are your thoughts about economics and security? And do you think that incentives are simply incorrectly configured to result in secure code these days?
Okay, so economic software. Well, one of the things that, you know, so I've talked to a lot of people who are like trying to deploy static analysis or other tools. And one of the things that I think people sometimes, first off, it's really hard to actually measure anything with regards to the economics of software development.
Right.
Very few people have a good handle on that. Any one problem that you might try to tackle, there are multiple ways to tackle that problem. Right. It's like, well, yes, you could do it this way, but, you know, it turns out there's another way which is going to cost you half as much. It'll mostly solve the same problem. And so it becomes very difficult to try to figure out how do I allocate my resources in terms of doing it. I guess one of the interesting questions is why don't the companies and so forth put adequate time on this, adequate resources? I think a lot of it is that for the most part, companies are making what they believe to be well-informed choices about, you know, well, it doesn't help if my software is a little bit more reliable if I lose out in the marketplace. And, you know, do we need to get companies to reallocate their priorities? I think some of it has to do with just lack of knowledge on the part of companies. I think the problem is that there are a lot of companies and so forth that don't realize that, okay, you've got a big security problem.
Yeah, the downstream risk is not clear.
Right. I mean, I think if a lot of these companies sort of had some sort of way to sort of know better, understand better that, okay, you know, somehow this slipped through your processing, your design, you totally forgot about security, and somebody should be like waving you down and saying, no, you've really got to put more time on this, I think they would say, oh, yeah, somehow that slipped by and we put the time on it. I think that's probably most of what happens, isn't that somebody made a decision, but somehow that it's not something that people, it's, you know, like you, it's, if you forget to measure or worry about your security,
it's hidden.
You know, there's nothing that jumps out at you. Whereas if you don't measure user satisfaction, if you don't measure performance, well, that becomes very obvious on day one.
So maybe some tweak to the incentives could help with that.
You know, I'm not sure how much of it is tweaks to the incentives.
Well, here's what I think. I think that people have this implicit requirement for security, but it's not ever made explicit. And the problem occurs is when you create software that doesn't meet those requirements that were never uttered explicitly, then they get really mad.
I mean, I think, so, you know, you've sort of commented before about how there are a lot of things which are badnessometers for software security and so forth. I think what we really sort of need is we need better, easy, dirt simple badnessometers. And, you know, if it was sort of like, okay, you know, all this stuff, read Gary's book and all that sort of stuff, people want to do that. But like if it was just, okay, we're going to have a set of badnessometers that we run on all of our software, and this can be either automatic tools or some checklists or things like that. And, you know, if the badnessometer comes up flashing red.
That's really bad.
That's really bad, and you got to do something, right?
Yeah.
And I guess, so here's an interesting question. Of the places which have had severe software security problems, how many of them were places where using some simple badnessometers would have flashed red? And yeah, I mean, sometimes you have a security problem because you were doing, you had the right thing in mind, you were putting effort towards this, and something sneaked by.
Yeah, or you had a subtle bug, sure.
Right.
And others are just plain old dumb.
Right. But yeah. I would guess that a lot of the software security problems we have are because something was so obviously just not paid attention to that a badnessometer should have been flashing red?
Yeah, I'd say maybe half. That's mm-hmm. what I think, or maybe slightly less than half.
And that seems like the easiest thing to address, yep. rather than the subtle bugs that crept in even though you had good intentions.
Sure. So, you know, when you're using static analysis, that'll find some categories of bugs. One might argue that that's a kind of an interesting badnessometer.
Yeah, but the problem is a lot of the commercial tools, they're really tuned towards giving a security professional good feedback on how to make this code really airtight.
Right.
They're not tuned to be a simple badnessometers, right? Mm-hmm. They give, oh, we've got 500 warnings, and you're going to have to look through these because you want to be sure that they're all really good. Whereas a simple sort of tool set that says, you know, you're generating SQL statements with string concatenation, and you just shouldn't be doing that.
Right. Cut it out.
Right. There are some of these tools, but just like I said, most of the tools, things like Coverity, Fortify, and so forth, Cell, they're really designed for people who are trying to get software to the point where it's bulletproof.
Right.
Right. And it really needs a different sort of setting and use model to say, no, we just want a, you know, to know whether or not to turn on the red siren that you haven't paid attention to this at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So you're going to retire from Maryland in January 2012.
Yes.
What's next for Bill? We looked on Twitter. It didn't say anything.
Right. So I don't know. So after being a professor 23 years, I've decided I want to do something different, probably doing more having to do with software development and so forth. Problem is, as a professor, you can't give 2 weeks' notice or even a month's notice.
Right, right.
And I'm sort of at the point where I'm, you know, going to retire. I've got at least two open source, if not three or four open source efforts I'm involved in,
yep.
that need more time than I can give them right now. And I'm probably figuring that I can take a few months to spend more time on some of my open source projects, pick up some of the skill sets that I've been meaning to pick up for a while
uh-huh.
and haven't, and, you know, then do things like, because I've got the Marmoset system, I want to push that to get it to at least six other large universities. And mm-hmm. at that point, we'll sort of see if this is going to be something which is going to grow to 1,000 universities or not.
Mm-hmm.
I've got at least one idea for a startup. I know somebody else who's got a small startup in the Bethesda, Maryland area that I might work with.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have anything planned. I'm, you know, maybe
it's kind of exciting, actually.
It is. It's, you know, a little bit exciting, you know, like, when I did my skydive or stuck a flaming torch in my mouth.
Yeah, so that's my very last question is, what the heck made you take up fire eating? And by the way, thanks for lighting the bonfire.
Yes. So this was while I was on sabbatical out at Google in Mountain View. I guess this is about 2 years ago. There's this place in Oakland, California called The Crucible,
mm-hmm.
which they had had their fire truck out at the Maker Faire in California. They were belching big things of flame and so mm-hmm, forth, mm-hmm. showing off. And the Crucible is a place where they have classes in arc welding, flame working, you know, glass, blacksmithing, and fire performance.
So and you went sort of, there.
Yeah, and I was sort of, well, you know, it was sort of like, okay, I'm getting down to my last weeks in California. What are some things that I can do in California that I can't do back in Maryland? And I looked at Chris and said, oh, this one weekend I have free. They have a class in fire eating.
Uh-huh.
So I took a one weekend class in fire eating.
There you have it. You may be the only super hardcore computer scientist fire eater on the planet.
I don't know. Maybe.
Who knows?
I'd be surprised. But certainly I do not know of any other coding fire eaters.
Well, thanks, Bill. It's been fun.
Good. Thank you, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The September-October issue of IEEE S&P is a special issue on cyber war. The interview department features our chat with CBS reporter Eleanor Mills. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.